Good morning once again, and welcome to our conference. I'm Kathleen Bailey. I teach in the political science department here at Boston College, and I'm also associate director of the Islamic Civilization and Societies program. We are delighted again to co-sponsor this event with Peace Island Institute, Turkish Cultural Center of Boston, Kokolis from a program at Harvard, and Boise Center at Boston College. This is an event in the ICS Distinguished Lecture Series, which is a continuing lecture series. So I invite you to go to our website, and you can see other upcoming events that we have in the end of March and all through April, and I think even into May. And then I also would like to turn your attention to another insert in the folder that you received. Concerns the Dunya Ensemble, which is a musicians collective. They've played here at Boston College, and we're delighted to have them back again in the fall. And they're working on some original music. If you haven't heard of them, or if you haven't heard them, it's really quite a treat. They explore a whole variety of Turkish and Ottoman music. So please, again, go to our website, and you'll find in a few weeks the date for that concert. And Turkish food as well will be served. So I think that's the definition of heaven, maybe. So I hope that you'll join us for that in the fall. The second panel today, Turks Abroad, Political and Religious Interests, is an exploration of how Muslim immigrants interpret and practice their faith in Europe and the diversity of those interpretations, and how governments across Europe have responded to the growing presence of Muslim immigration. And of course, this gives rise to a whole series of controversial questions, which will be explored by our panelists, of whether, for example, Muslim immigration represents a threat to European liberal democracy, which was touched on at the end of the first panel, and if and how European governments have attempted to reach out to Muslim communities to accommodate them or to give them a respectful place in society or incorporate them into the fabric of European democracy. So we have two esteemed panelists to answer those questions. Before I introduce them, I would like to mention that in the tables, the table in the back, there are four books authored or co-authored by some of our panelists. They are 20% off the publisher's price, and they will take cash, checks, or credit cards. The books, besides the two that I'll mention in a minute by our two panelists that have been recently published, Also, Brahmacharan's Between Islam and the State is there, and Amit Kuru, the two panelists from the first panel, Democracy, Islam, and Secularism in Turkey, are available. So please do browse that table. The bookstore will be here until 4:30, so you've got plenty of time to do that. All right, now, it's my pleasure to introduce our two panelists. Our first panelist is my colleague from the Political Science Department at Boston College, Dr. Jonathan Lawrence. He's Associate Professor of Political Science, and his latest book, available at that table, is The Emancipation of Europe's Muslims, was published just a few weeks ago. Professor Lawrence is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a term member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and a faculty affiliate of the Center for European Studies at Harvard. He received his PhD and MA from Harvard, his CEP from Sciences Po, and his BA from Cornell. Our second panelist is Amit Euclien. He's assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Mississippi's Cross Center for International Studies. His research interests include anthropology of religion, ethnicity, Muslims in Europe, Islamic movements, and multiculturalism. He teaches courses on ethnic and religious identity politics, and he is the author of, again, the just released and available, Localizing Islam in Europe. He received his PhD from Boston University, his MA from the University of Denver, and his BA from Bill Kent University. So I think first up, we'll have Professor Lawrence.
Thank you very much. So I'd like to speak a little bit about the growing conflicts between two trends. And one is that European governments have been trying, I think, for the last 10 or 15 years to increasingly assert their ownership, their inclusiveness, and their incorporation of a growing Muslim minority, of course, originating in labor migration, beginning in the late 50s and 1960s, that has led to a large Muslim minority across the continent. Right now, there are around 17 or 18 million individuals of Muslim background in Western Europe. And so on the one hand, you have this growing realization, this growing trend of inclusiveness. The most significant of these gestures, I think, has come really from the German government back in 1999, when they reformed their citizenship law so that from 2000 onwards, all or most foreign, most children born to one foreign parent could become German citizens automatically. So on the one hand, you have this inclusiveness, you have an increasing recognition of Islam as the practice, as a religion practiced by citizens of European countries. And on the other hand, we also see an increasingly assertive role being played by what were the countries of origin for these migrant populations. And since we're here to talk about Turkey today, I'm going to focus on the Turkish case. But honestly, you could choose other countries to focus on in quite similar terms as well, because they're not alone in pursuing their contacts and outreach and really intertwined relationship with their diaspora, not only in Western Europe, but really elsewhere in the world, wherever you find people of Turkic origins, from China to Central Asia to Western Europe. And so I'd like to talk about maybe some of the tensions between these two trends. The Europeanization of Muslims and Turkish origin Europeans on the one hand, and yet the sustained interest of the Turkish government in maintaining the Turkishness of these populations. Now, the next generation of European Muslims and of Turkish Europeans will have been born, for the most part, in Europe. There are, in addition to the approximately 4 million or so people of Turkish origin in Western Europe, around 3 million Algerians, there are around 3.5 million Moroccans, there are more than 2 million Pakistanis, right? And each of these governments is, in fact, trying to make sure that their diasporas and the descendants of their diaspora are following an Islam that is more or less at peace with the rule of law, including maintaining a good relationship with the European host governments. And you could say that this is something of a surprising phenomenon, because the social science literature on immigrant integration suggests that the ties between sending countries and their immigrants tends to diminish over time, especially over the generations, and yet we see this unexpected resurgence of governmental activity, whether it's coming from Rabat or from Algiers, or indeed from Ankara. Now, historically, there are very practical reasons for this. The labor migration diaspora in Europe was a source of hard currency, frankly, for developing economies during the second half of the 20th century. And I have on the handout here just two charts of remittances. And you can see, it's a little bit small, I apologize, but on the bottom, the line in the graph that has the square is Turkey. It peaks around 1999, goes down then until about 2003, and then starts to grow again. And I'm interested in that last little tale of growth here in remittances, because I think it reflects a renewed interest in the diaspora. And that was really one of the traditional reasons for the interest of the sending state in the diaspora abroad. The other principal reason, of course, was to prevent the growth of religious or political movements abroad that could threaten the Kemalist or secularist regime at home, right? So there's at once a kind of friendly relationship, encouraging foreign direct investment, encouraging cash remittances on behalf of economic development. And then on the other hand, you have this kind of wary eye being cast across the Mediterranean to Europe, where, of course, the relative political freedoms of association and religion and expression during these times of more illiberalism in Turkish politics allowed Islamist movements, of course, to thrive and flourish outside of the country. And so there was a great interest in Ankara in simply keeping tabs on this population. Now, in the last several years, under the current majority government of the AKP, of the Justice and Development Party, we see a marked increase in this outreach, and interestingly, a formalization of the outreach. And on the back of the handout, you'll see two slides. One is a map where the dark squares represent offices administered by something called the Presidency for Turks and Related Communities Abroad, which is a way of, again, keeping in touch with the diaspora and also providing practical services for what are still a great number of Turkish citizens, right? Remember that many of the new citizenship laws and nationality reforms in Europe aren't going to take effect really for another generation. So Turkish outreach to Turks in Europe is really, to a large extent, a government communicating with its citizens, right? And so there's a certain legitimacy in that, of course, that, however, is going to be destined to be questioned over time as the citizenship of the individuals in question tends to be more and more European and less Turkish. In the case of Germany, of course, the citizenship reform did not allow for double nationality. Now, that's something that in the German mind is fairly fixed and certain and enduring. And they have, in the cases of Turkish Germans who have given up their Turkish citizenship in order to take the German citizenship and then walked around the block and gotten their Turkish passport back from the consulate or embassy, the German government has gone ahead and denaturalized those Turkish Germans. So the German government means business on this. The Turkish government, however, in my conversation with officials, does not see this necessarily as an enduring aspect of German legislation. And I think they're less certain that dual nationality will always be forbidden in Germany and Europe. And that's a very interesting perspective as well, because it hints at the potential for political mobilization of Turkish Germans, in this case, as Turkish Germans, right, on behalf of an interest that is really specific to them as a collectivity, as a group, backed, of course, by their ancestral government. So, in addition to the Presidency for Turks and Related Communities Abroad, which was really just created in 2010, you also had a reform of the Diyanet that we were discussing in the first panel, this Presidency for Religious Affairs, which established new bylaws for the organization and also started to streamline its activities in Europe on behalf of Turkish populations abroad in the area of religious affairs. So everything having to do with Islam, prayer spaces, making sure there are trained imams coming from Turkey to be of service to Turkish communities abroad. Imams, of course, who are trained in the Imam Hatip Lycees, and who are effectively coming and being paid for by Diyanet in cooperation with the host government, right? So they need a visa to come over as a clergyman. So they get a special four-year visa. And what's different now about 30 years ago is that the Turkish government is cooperating really hand in glove with the European governments to facilitate services like that. So that the imams who are arriving in Cologne or Dusseldorf or in Lyon or in Birmingham or in Rotterdam, they're no longer coming from, you know, the quote-unquote Anatolian hinterland, right? They are coming now armed with knowledge about the culture and language and society of their destination country. And that's a big difference. So even though we see this increase in governmental activity, it's been sort of softened and it's now being channeled through new European mechanisms to essentially collaborate with the Turkish government on behalf of Turkish Europeans' religious activities. So I think that what that shows is that we're seeing an interesting paradigm shift within Turkish strategy vis-a-vis its diaspora. And that it has gone effectively from being a relationship that was focused almost exclusively on those two aspects I mentioned at the beginning, the remittance and financial aspect and the sort of radicalism or terrorism aspect. And it's becoming something more constructive and perhaps more optimistic, so that the government in Ankara has a more flexible conceptualization of what it means to be of Turkish origin. They used to be quite jealous of European governments who were attempting to integrate Turks. They discouraged the taking on of the nationality. They discouraged also through their strict inheritance laws and laws regarding military conscription. They essentially made it very hard to get rid of your Turkish nationality up until about the mid to late 1990s. And they started to change around then, and then European governments followed essentially within about 5 years. So that you have this new conception where they're not quite Turkish Germans or Turkish Frenchmen or Turkish Dutch. They are French, Germans, Dutch, but that have a kind of citizenship light that is still based in Ankara. And that you can see through these two new and improved institutions, namely the Presidency for Religious Affairs and its European operations, and the Presidency for Turks and Related Communities Abroad and its operations. And it's very impressive if you go to Ankara and visit these, especially the new building for the new Presidency for Turks and Related Communities Abroad. It's a 10-story building with hundreds of employees busily working on responding to the concerns of Turks living in Europe and elsewhere. And again, I want to emphasize this is not a uniquely Turkish story. If you go to the capital of Morocco, you'll find really almost the exact same thing. And since Turkey and Morocco are the main countries of origin of most European Muslims, it makes a certain amount of sense. Now, of course, not everybody in the diaspora is interested in this outreach from the Turkish state. Many of them don't feel some innate connection to their parents' or grandparents' homeland and are happy to have nothing to do with it. There are also minorities that have been traditionally excluded from institutions like the Diyanet, such as Alevis, who are slowly experiencing a kind of overture by the new direction of the Diyanet, but who traditionally have really organized themselves separately in parallel institutions with their own gem houses, their own houses of prayer, and really their own religious practices. The same, I would say, has gone for what is the Milliyetçilik movement abroad, that is perhaps a forerunner of the AK Party, and very much in the intellectual legacy of Nesmettin Erbakan, which leads through a kind of winding path to today's Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan. So there are some who are uninterested in the government offering, even as it adapts and evolves to the new reality of Turkish Europeans. They just don't want to have anything to do with it. But the fact is that this prime minister, this government, has been extremely effective at cultivating a base within the diaspora abroad. And it's very interesting. Part of the reason is because European governments haven't done a very good job of making these Turkish communities feel 100% at home, right, and haven't quite successfully pursued all of the integration and incorporation strategies that they've begun. And this has left something of a vacuum and a void that, if it weren't filled by the Turkish state, in some cases has been and would be filled by far more dangerous influences. And if you go to speak with what are known as the DTIB offices abroad in Europe, which are independently run satellites of the Diyanet, you will see some evolution in the way that they have tried to adapt to local circumstances, but have not been completely successful. But Erdogan's personality has been a driving force in renewing the interest of Turks abroad in Turkey and in Turkish government in particular. Now, he has positioned himself as the champion of Turkish interests abroad, and he shows up periodically in European countries to give rousing speeches to Turkish origin audiences. For example, after there was an arson attack in which two Turkish Germans perished in 2009 in Germany, he came and gave a reassuring, made a series of reassuring appearances. When test scores and employment rates for Turkish Germans were lagging, he came and gave a speech about how he was tempted to open up Turkish language high schools in Germany, because if the German education system couldn't take care of them, well, then perhaps Turkey could. Now, he is, I think most people in this room know, an instinctive politician who's very well plugged in to his own emotions. But on the other hand, he had, I think, a real sincerity in his concern for the vulnerability of Turkish origin minorities abroad. And he's not totally off on this front. They're unliked in polls in Europe. They underperform on the job market. They're underrepresented in politics. And so when Erdogan comes, for example, to Cologne in Germany and gives a speech about how assimilation is to be avoided at all costs, right, that it's even comparable to a crime against humanity because it's killing the culture of origin, he is sending a message to which Turkish Europeans, I think, are increasingly receptive. And that has partly to do simply with his good political instincts as a kind of political boss, and knowing the way that the rendering of services to people can translate into political loyalty. And that's one way I think you can interpret the growth of these institutions and their activities abroad. Now, this begs the question, of course, as to why this, frankly, semi-paternalist approach, or how the semi-paternalist approach is being received in the European countries themselves, not necessarily by the targeted groups, but by the governments who have been trying for 20 years to develop their own integration policies and then all of a sudden see that someone else, and indeed many other actors, are also making inroads into the same population. And I'd just like to speak briefly about two episodes that I think encapsulate the potential response by European countries as well as the potential strength in the Turkish approach for the future of Turkish political influence in Europe. In Germany last March, exactly a year ago, after Erdogan gave his speech in Dusseldorf in which he suggested that Turks in Germany should learn Turkish first and then German, this created a firestorm, because the only people who are serious about integration policy in Germany, in the Länder where the integration policy really gets made, have insisted and fought for the children of migrant kids to have access to German language education as early as possible. German schools only obligatory from the ages of 6 to 16, and in the view of many, it's the missing those first couple years of speaking German with your peers that puts you at a longer-term disadvantage, and because of the way the German education system is organized, you get tracked very early as 9 or 10, and for many Turkish Germans, that track simply leads to vocational school. And if you do not graduate with the appropriate diploma, which is to say an Abitur, from a so-called gymnasium, so the academic high school, it's very hard to make it to university. And in fact, the last time the statistics were released, there were more students of Chinese nationality in German universities than there were of Turkish nationality, which is surprising. The number was in the low 20,000s, but that's also surprising. So when he suggested that Turkish Germans should learn Turkish first, this raised the hackles of the German government, in particular of the German integration minister, who for the first time is a cabinet-level minister under the government of Angela Merkel. And she said something novel for a German politician. She said, "We are ready to integrate Turkish Germans. But in order for that to happen, the Turkish state has to let go first." Those were very strong words. And this claim, of course, that Germany is ready to integrate Turkish Germans, you could say is on somewhat shaky ground, if you were to rely just on the kind of newspaper stories. But in fact, if you look at what the Länder are doing in terms of organizing religious education for Muslims on an equal basis with other religious communities, for example, in North Rhine-Westphalia, which is where a million German Muslims live, there will be religion course in public schools from now on for Muslim kids. There are now imam training programs in different universities. There are German Muslim theologians who are getting their doctorates for the first time. There is the slow creation of essentially a German-based, at least in this area of religion, a German-based Islam, which suggests that they are ready to make this claim and to ask the Turkish state to let go. But, of course, that's not at all the direction that these things are going. The second case I will mention briefly is in France, which concerns the January law that was passed that made it a crime to deny the Armenian genocide in particular. There were already laws about genocide denial, but this was something that was pushed through first in December and then finally passed in January. Now, in December, there was a small protest against the first reading of the law in the National Assembly. Around 5,000 or so Turkish Frenchmen showed up to protest. They thought that they had essentially been out-lobbied once again by the French Armenians, who have been there a little bit longer, but who, in fact, there are only about 50 or 60,000 French Armenians. There are around 500 or 600,000 French Turks. Right, so this is a disparate relationship, numerically speaking, but the Turks feel that they're constantly being out-lobbied by the Armenians when it comes to this question. And when the January reading of the bill took place, so 1 month after these 5,000 folks turned up, an entire coalition, really a rainbow coalition of Turkish organizations, put together 526 buses and bussed in 40,000 protesters to speak out against the passage of the bill. And this included the Turkish Federation of France, which is a secular nationalist organization. It included Milli Görüş, which is an Islamist group that seeks ties with the German with European governments, and it included the DTIP, right? So the actual outpost of the Turkish government. So this was really a broad coalition, and the spokesman for this coalition, said, you know, President Sarkozy has managed to do something that we as organizers have been unable to do for the last, you know, 30 years since Turks moved to Germany, which is France, which is to unite Turks as a collective group. So these two cases, of course, suggest that there's a lot at stake for Turkish Europeans, that the Turkish government is very aware of this and doing its best to shape outcomes, and European governments may be in a somewhat dormant state on that front because of their own nativist and populist challenges that are essentially preventing governments from pursuing the kind of courageous integration policies that they did about a decade ago. Now, the Turkish government probably won't be able to speak on behalf of Turks abroad eternally or indefinitely, but they're going to try to. And European governments will either have successfully integrated these populations and feel comfortable with their ties with the homeland, as they do, of course, already with other groups, such as Armenians or Jews or you know, Lebanese, etc. But there's one sort of final twist in this story, which is an electoral one. And we know that seats in the Turkish parliament are at a premium, especially when it comes to determining the size of one's majority. And one of the things that the AK Party government has done is really pushed to make it easier for Turks abroad to vote in elections. They've been unable to do so far. They've made it possible to vote at the border now. But one of the things that I think Prime Minister Erdogan would really like to do is to turn this into kind of a solid constituency, which it already is, but one which has then political representation in the parliament in Ankara, which, again, so long as we're speaking about Turkish citizens, makes a certain amount of sense. Italy does the same thing. A number of other countries have districts for citizens abroad. But if you have this confusion between Turks and related communities and diasporas, obviously the issue gets a lot fuzzier and the questions get a lot more profound when it comes to who is really in charge of the future of Turkish Europeans. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure for me to be here. This is, I have to admit, like a homecoming. All right, granted that I'm not a graduate of BC, but of BU, I still feel very welcome.
No.
So, and I've checked many books when I was doing my studies here, so thank you for all of that. And here are the fruits. I've done my, hopefully, jobs in the years, and here I am, talking about my book, Localizing Islam in Europe, Turkish Islamic Communities in Germany and the Netherlands. This has taken, of course, years of fieldwork under the supervision of very important advisors and scholars, among them especially here, Professor White, Jenny White, and many others in this crowd. So I thank you all for your contributions in my academic life and scholarship. This question on understanding Turkish Islam, if you will, or Islam in general in Europe has been formulated, this versus question, this opposition question, which in some ways we already handled in the first panel. I think it'll continue on. As it is formulated by people I would call essentialists, is whether Islam and Europe, or Islam and the West, or Islam and modernity, are compatible or incompatible. But thankfully, we have really great scholars among us who are challenging this question itself. And Berna has already started doing that with her work. And I want to really continue on that. And I see that, having sociologists, anthropologists, and political scientists together makes a nice combination to rethink this question and phrase it in the following terms. How do Muslim actors engage with liberal democracy in practice? So, we may not have philosophers or, theorists yet, but I think in practice something is cooking. And my work is really talking about that process, which is really largely a result of pragmatism, inconsistencies, and improvisations in the activism of these actors that look in my work. And the argument that I really make is that these Islamic actors learn by doing. Very simple way, we have done it in our lives, you know, all of us, while children in particular, but in an ongoing process. So you make mistakes, you know, you take another step, you fall, you try, and then you get your balance. So that's the light in which I see my work, which really comprises of comparing nearly all the major Turkish Islamic organizations. Now, thankfully, Jonathan has already did a wonderful coverage of Diyanet. So, you know, I don't really have to talk in detail about that, but a very important organization that is, because it has the largest institutional frame. They have the largest number of mosques. If you, for instance, look at Germany, they have maybe close to 800 mosques. But the other organizations that I've looked into, I would argue, they are much more active on the ground. They are much more engaging. And I think new ideas are emerging. So that's the kind of stories that I'm after. The larger framework, which I will not go into the detail as I just alluded to, refers to this essentialist ideas. Well, essentialism, not only for Islam, but in general, as an approach, assumes that we can somehow access a core of an entity. And it could be a religion, it could be political ideology, whatever it is. But that's really flawed. Why is it flawed? Because it assumes that somehow if you just go to the sacred texts, and if you just look at the historical origin of a religion, you can capture those major principles, and that's it. You know? It's so simply misleading, though. So you can get it. That's the assumption. When you hear, as in Kuru's presentations of Huntington or Lewis, Bernard Lewis, you can see, you know, ideas that really reflect that approach. Clearly, you know, sacred texts can be treated selectively, history, same manner. It all really depends on how people who are acting on behalf of Muslims understand those texts, and that history is really the question that we are after, especially as anthropologists, but of course largely all the scholarly community. That approach is called the contextualist approach. We try to understand the people, their lives, you know, their concerns, not just their religious identity, but their, you know, roles as brothers, sisters, parents, you know, their role, life as men, as women, as a member of a certain socioeconomic class, and on. Because those aspects will shape the way they understand their religions. Okay, and that negotiation happens especially in a very strong manner within the Islamic authorities. And there are various types of competing Islamic authorities who want to have a greater say of what true Islam is. Right, so what true Marxism is, you know, for different ideologies. So everybody's playing that game of having a greater power, having a greater position of authority to define what that true, you know, form of Islam is. When it comes to talking about Muslims in Europe, the very phrase is, of course, very misleading, because those Islamic authorities are there. But they have come, have acquired that role as a result of this socio-economic context, the context of labor migration, right? A particular group of people have arrived to Western Europe as a result of this migration, labor migration, largely rural socio-economic status. But that's changing in generations, so their understandings of Islam is also changing. But the phrase Muslims in Europe is misleading, because that gets to think us that it is as if it's a very recent phenomenon. Let's keep in mind, remind ourselves, and sometimes I do that to myself now and then, that large communities of Muslims have been living on the European continent since the 8th century. Right? Think of Al-Andalus, think of the Ottomans, beginning with the 14th century. So, and think of maybe close to 10 million indigenous Muslim population living in southeastern Europe, right? The Albanians, the Bosnians, and so on and so forth. So let's keep in mind that we are really talking about an immigrant origin, Muslim population, let's say, in Western Europe. Having said that, that group really didn't define itself as primarily as Muslim to begin with. And here's a confession that comes out. You know, my father actually was one of the first immigrants, first to Germany and to the Netherlands. And he used to tell that in his time, in the late 60s, people have used this phrase, Islam Edirne'de kaldı. Islam is left back, behind, in Edirne, the westernmost border city of Turkey. So it's kind of like you drop it there. That is to say, nobody was talking about Islam, nobody was really practicing. So that was really the mood. And instead, it was this whole idea of being guest workers, like Gastarbeiters, as they were named. Thus, their the labor, for instance, labor unions were the most active organizations to organize their lives in the 60s and the 70s. And that started to change in the 80s and 90s because of family unification. In that time period, we start to see that the families are coming in, so institutions of religion and culture are being built. And then in that process, the same group of people now came to be referred to as Turks and Moroccans and Tunisians and so on and so forth. That is, ethnic origin was taking place instead of this kind of class-based definition of the same group of people. And we can say that by the year 2000s, we get to call the same group of people now by their religion. We call them Muslims. This overlap is very significant to understand the context of these Muslims, because religion is not their only or their primary identity, and at least not in all the acts they do. Thus, when you hear about, you know, Muslim youth rioting in France, as it was called in 2005, you are really missing the point, because then people tend to think that it's really something to do with their religion. And of course, that's why they call these imams to tell these young, you know, French, disenfranchised, you know, guys who are really unhappy with the French state to stop burning these cars, and they don't care. Of course they don't, because that's not, you know, religion doesn't play a role in that. It happens to be that these guys, you know, have origins or their generations in North Africa and other places. That's the connection. But that shift in the naming is pretty significant to understand the context of these group of people. The other important element of this context is this overlap of poverty, ethnicity, and religion. That is, the same group of people, you know, sharing low socioeconomic status, a particular ethnicity that's attributed to that group, be it Moroccan, Pakistani, or Turkish, as well as religion, Muslim. Because that equation is very difficult to break. And unless you break that, you can't really become full participant of a society. Just as a comparable example, you can think of the African American population here, their socioeconomic status, and in terms of racial politics, and how it's so difficult to disentangle the two, both for the group group of people, for the minority, as well as for the larger society. If you look at the numbers, I'm not going to go in that, you know, in detail, but since we're talking about Turkish Muslims, as you well know, more than 2/3 of the Muslims in Germany in particular are of Turkish origin. And in the Netherlands, they're about half of all Muslims in the Netherlands, which is about to be 1 million. So these are the two countries I've looked at more greater depth. But one thing that is, I think, important to remind us is that Turkish Muslims are the largest group of Muslims that come from a single country in Western Europe. And I think it's understudied in that regard. We read a lot about, you know, Muslims from North African origin or Pakistani origin, let's say, living in different parts of Europe, but not as much work on the Turkish Muslims. And I think in terms of the query question in the beginning that I posed, how do Muslim actors engage with liberal democracy, Turkish Muslims could actually make an interesting case. So I think there is something that needs to be elaborated, and I think that's useful. The authorities that speak on behalf of Islam among the Turkish, let's say, origin Muslims living in Europe, we have various major groups of people that I have looked closely into. And I have grouped them as ideal types, if you will. The first group, official Islam, which is already described by Jonathan. So I'm not going to go into the details of that, the Diyanet or the Paris Mosque for Algerian Muslims. It's a tool of controlling or trying to control, let's say, this diaspora. And the type of Islam is largely focusing on ethical principles as well as ritual practice rather than any engagement with politics. So try to avoid it as much as you can. That's one of the principles. And trying to unite the nation through religion is the goal of this kind of official Islam. The second group I talk about is the traditionalists. Well, these could be groups such as the Tablighi Jamaat or the Süleymanlı, as they're also called Süleymancı. It's a Nakşi origin group that's very active among the Turkish Muslim community in Europe and elsewhere, including the U.S. So they do have several mosques as well. And in this approach, you just accept the received tradition and do not question it, but just practice it and become better Muslims. That's the goal. So through Quranic courses, through invoking a more pious life, reminding Prophet Muhammad's life, that's a traditionalist approach. The third group, which could be called political Islamist, or at least in terms of their origins, we can think groups of Muslim Brotherhood, Milli Görüş, or Cemaat-i İslami. The original project of political Islamism was, of course, to some extent, change public life according to Islamic law. But what happened in time, both for these countries of origins and their original projects, where the original projects of Islamism has emerged, as well as, and certainly more, in their branches of these organizations in Europe, their goal has shifted, has changed. It has changed out of the reason that the people who live there start to have different priorities. Their goals are no longer changing politics in their countries of origin. Their goal is to give a better education to their, to their next generation. And to get their Muslim identity accepted in the European public sphere. So those are become their priorities. The fourth group I talk about is referred to as civil Islam. This group, I think, is particularly important because new ideas could come out of practice of the activism of the groups within this category. And I put Gülen movement in this group in particular, as well as certain Sufi organizations. Here, the goal is try to educate pious generations who are not avoiding modernity, but try to engage with it, especially in the educational field. So they are not like some Sufis, let's say, staying in their corners, but trying to change society by engaging with it. And that very process is actually transforming them. So that's the part, and I will give more examples on that. That's the civil Islam. There are civil Islamic movements in Indonesia, in other places, so the term has been used for explaining some of these movements. The last group is what I refer to as revolutionary. You have the Kaplan community or Kaplancılar, which used to be an active group in the 80s and 90s. Nowadays, you can think of groups such as Hizb ut-Tahrir or Salafi Jihadist, whose goal are really bringing the religion and state together in a country, trying to make sure that they are combined, and use violence if necessary. So these are some of my categories and the groups that I've looked into. I'm not going to give all the numbers, but just to give you a sense, in Germany, for instance, if you look at Diyanet, close to 800 mosques, Milli Görüş, more than 300, close to maybe 350. The exact figures are in my book, as incidentally, you may want to look at it. Or the Süleymanlı, who have close to 300, the Gülen, about 200 institutions. And again, for the Gülen case, for instance, these are tutoring centers and schools rather than mosques. So they have a different type of organization. And the Kaplan community has been banned in 2001 in Germany. And I visited some of their ex-mosques. But they have disappeared, not really because they were banned, but they had already lost in the 1990s. The reason they lost is really at the heart of what I try to explain. And that is these Islamic communities, in Turkish they're called cemaats, if you'll, or movements, are in competition with one another to serve their constituencies, that is to try to get more followers to their movements. In order to do that, they compete with one another. So who is coming up with a, let's say, a project, a program that appeals to greater people? Well, that group actually picks up more followers. And they also have a relationship with the state, which was explained. So the state regulates, you know, and they also want to be recognized by the state. So they have a relationship with the state, and while they're addressing the needs and the concerns of their of Muslims in general, and they're negotiating in between these two groups while also competing with one another. So that's really the larger structure, what I call the structure of the Islamic field in Europe. Now, here I'm coming to the core of my argument. So what do I mean by localizing Islam in Europe? I'll just give three examples. The first one concerns state policies and Islam. My argument is that multicultural state policies facilitate localization of Islam. It causes Islam to be reinterpreted, to be adapted to the local conditions. The example I bring in is from Milli Görüş. When I compared Milli Görüş in Germany and in the Netherlands, I found that the Dutch Milli Görüş is much more willing to reconsider their positions and reinterpret some of the most contested questions, such as gender relations. The Dutch have promoted gender equality at housework. It was a large program under the Ministry of Social Affairs. And the Milli Görüş in the Netherlands wanted to participate in that, which they did. And they have come up with sermons. So in these sermons, and I've talked to the gentleman who has actually authored this sermon, which was delivered in the Friday sermons in all the mosques of Milli Görüş. In the sermon, it reminds the listeners, and this time you just imagine it's all men, you know, largely, you know, women in Turkey often don't go to Friday prayers. So it's a group of men on a Friday where the sermon is talking and reminding them how Muhammad, Prophet of Islam, was mending his own clothes, was helping at housework, how just he was to his wives. And by reminding how a prophet as a model, right, for all Muslims, was living a life that promotes, let's say, gender equality at housework, the listeners are reminded how to actually act in their lives. This was a result of an interaction with the state, because the state promotes, right, and on the one hand, you know, this kind of project, but it also started to recognize Milli Görüş as a legitimate actor. You know, Milli Görüş, even today, for instance, in Germany, this is not the case, where Milli Görüş is still branded somewhat of an extremist, you know, of a group that is a threat to the constitution and so on. Whereas in the Netherlands, they used to do that in the late 1990s, but with this shift from, you know, with this change, let's say, in Dutch Milli Görüş, they're no longer there. So they're recognized now as a legitimate actor. So, of course, I've given you one example, but the examples can, you know, there's a long list of examples of how this interaction actually really played itself out. So I'll be glad to take more questions on that if you like. The second major way in which this localization happens is through activism. Activities in the fields of community development, education, and public sphere make Islam more adaptive to local conditions. Here I want to bring an example from how interfaith dialogue activism can lead to pluralism, a more pluralistic understanding. One of the most leading activists in the Netherlands within the Gulen community there shared his views of how he changed in time through interfaith dialogue. He said, well, in the 1990s, my goal in engaging interfaith dialogue was to outreach to non-Muslims. That's the only way you can get in touch with non-Muslims. You know, you want to be able to share, right, your values, your beliefs. And this was a good strategy, if you will, to be able to do that. But he said, the more I talked to, you know, my interlocutors, the more I understood that we all want the same things. You know, we want justice. We want clean environment. We want to have peace in this world. So that kind of realization caused him to rethink his position. He said, well, you know, people are not, and they don't convert to Islam, let's say, because of the books you give or because of the ideas you tell them. But if you help them, you know, if they need anything, if you are there for them, that is to say, through this interpersonal relationship. And that relationship has caused him to rethink his justification for interfaith dialogue. So it's now no longer the differences of religion that is a reason to get together, but neighborly relations. So now he's justifying his goal to a bridging activity, to outreach out, you know, out of his community, you know, and to a non-Muslim larger society by saying, by reminding people that in Islam, going back to tradition, so the tradition is always part of this justification process, that, you know, having neighborly relations is a religious requirement. Prophet did that, regardless of the faith of your neighbor. You have to have good neighborly relations. So that justification sort of creates this spatial proximity, if you will, as a basis for interacting with the larger society. And as soon as I've listened all to that, I said, you should really write these down. I said, you know, as a scholar, I think you should write these down so everybody can read. And then he says, well, you see, people can only learn this by doing. Yeah, they have to go through this process that I have gone through. So I think this process is really significant, that they transform themselves, you know, with that process. Third piece, Muslim integration. These various movements that I have looked into are not only doing bonding activities, you know, coming together, you know, education, Quranic schools, you know, socializing among themselves, but they're also doing bridging activities, outreach activities. That is, you know, and when they come up with educational projects, they invite anyone, you know, that is to say, like tutoring centers. And such activities, again, you know, are making them much more connected to the larger part of the society. Young leadership is emerging out of this interaction. Young people are demanding to have their say in these activities, in these programs. They want to be recognized as the new leaders. Just with one example I want to explain and then really conclude, this process of localization, of rethinking Islamic tradition as a result of their presence and experience in these countries. The example comes from financial interest, riba. So in the Quran, it says, you know, financial interest taking or giving is prohibited. Well, it says riba is prohibited, but some people have interpreted it in this way. So then the question is, you see, in the 80s, none of these Islamic movements have permitted, if you will, have thought that getting a house with mortgage, with bank loan is allowed. None of them thought of it this way. But by the 1990s, that started to change, coincidentally, right? Because by the 1990s, people really wanted to come to realize that they're there for good, that they're going to be there for permanent, which means that you want to buy houses if you're going to live there, you know, for the rest of your life and for your children, right? So, I mean, of course, it's very difficult to see the causal relationship here, but which really caused the other. But these practical circumstances and this rethinking came at the same time, right? That now people are saying, well, it's really out of necessity, and then there are, of course, other reasonings as well through which they justify that if you want to buy a house through bank loan, it's allowed. Of course, there are other alternative systems, you know, loaning systems and so on people have created, but this is now, for instance, in Milli Görüş Fetwa declarations. You can actually find it there. And I've actually talked to, you know, followers of other movements who share the same kind of approach now, that you can buy it in the 80s and people didn't, you know, were not allowed to do that. That's really the process in which this is happening. But it is, of course, there are challenges on the way. I can talk more about that in the QA. This whole issue of turning Muslims into a security problem due to global politics, the rise of far-right parties and their discourse turns Muslims into the other of Europe, and the revolutionary Islamists, especially the Salafist jihadists, who are really creating, you know, who are marginal, less than 1%, but have a big public visibility. And also my current work is about the growth of Salafism and its patterns and why it does not really pick up among the Turkish Muslims, whereas it's getting much more followers, let's say, among Moroccan Muslims, is some of the current research I'm doing. But So in order to answer the very first question we asked and conclude, how do Muslims, you know, actors engage with liberal democracy? Well, in that process, through activism, what we find is that their understanding of Islam is incrementally adapting to liberal democracy in Europe. Thank you.